Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Republicans are talking revenue. Democrats are talking entitlement reform. Is this progress? Amy Eddings in for Brian Lehrer on WNYC, WNYC.org, and New Jersey Public Radio. Good morning. Happy Cyber Monday. There seems to be some post-Thanksgiving goodwill in Washington, with prominent Republicans and Democrats taking to the Sunday talk shows to talk about where they can find common ground in negotiations to avoid the nation driving over that fiscal cliff. Remember that? No, it did not disappear as you were eating your turkey leftovers. The talk's continuing today. Let's find out where things stand with John Heilman of New York Magazine. John, welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, how's it going?
It's going really well. Did you have a great Thanksgiving?
I did. I'm still high on tryptophan, but apart
from that, this is a good time to talk to you.
Yeah, it's a very good time. I'm feeling jovial.
Maybe that's what's in the air in Washington.
Absolutely right.
Post-turkey glow. So yesterday on ABC, the number one Republican in the Senate, Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, did something that on its face seems like a pretty big deal. He said he would ignore influential conservative Grover Norquist and break the so-called pledge that Republicans have taken not to raise taxes. Here's a clip of him.
When you're $16 trillion in debt, the only pledge we should be making to each other is to avoid becoming Greece. And Republicans should put revenue on the table. Capping deductions will help generate revenue. I agree with Grover, we shouldn't raise rates, but I think Grover is wrong when it comes to we can't cap deductions and buy down debt. I will violate the pledge, long story short, for the good of the country, only if Democrats will do entitlement reform.
Later in the day, Peter King, a congressman from New York, from Long Island, also said he'd break with the Norquist pledge. John, what are you reading in this? Are Republicans the first to blink in the post-Thanksgiving fiscal cliff staring contest?
Well, let's start with the fact that any sign that the Norquist pledge has less hold over the Republican Party is a good thing, because as a matter not of ideology but of math, we're going to need to raise revenue in addition to making long-term spending cuts in order to get the nation's fiscal house in order. Most of the Republicans, like Lindsey Graham, who have been talking about deviating from the Norquist pledge, however, have been on the Senate side. And unfortunately, although that is important in the long run because you got to get a deal with both the Senate and the House, the Senate is full of deal makers. And I don't think that the White House thinks or anyone else thinks that the problem here is going to be getting a deal with the Senate. There's a lot of Senate Republicans who are willing to make a deal of the kind that the president wants to see. The House Republicans have always been the more problematic group in terms of their insistence on not raising revenue. And you haven't heard as many House Republicans. Peter King is a notable exception who said that he doesn't care about Grover Norquist pledge. Where the House Republicans are right now is saying, we're willing to consider new revenue. We're willing to think about closing loopholes and getting rid of some deductions. But what we're not willing to do is to raise rates. And where the president is right now, although he said he's open to anything, he's pretty much saying, look, I have a mandate to raise rates on wealthy individuals. It's one of the most specific things I campaigned on in the 2012 presidential election was to say we're going to raise rates on people who on incomes over $250,000 a year. So there's still a long way to go to get to compromise. But, you know, the fact that Republicans are now Eric Cantor was on. I was on television this morning with Eric Cantor on Morning Joe, and he rightly pointed out that, you know, two summers ago when John Boehner and Barack Obama tried to negotiate a grand bargain, a lot of Republicans in the House said no to any new revenues. Now Republicans in the House are saying, well, at least we'll consider new revenues. So there's some progress, but we still have a decent way to go before we're going to be to nirvana.
Who do you want to hear from, or who do you think the White House needs to be hearing from in order to from the House side that would indicate that they're getting closer to nirvana, or at least holding hands and singing Kumbaya?
Well, I think
Cantor was an important voice.
Yeah, Cantor is an important voice for sure, and House Speaker John Boehner and Eric Cantor are saying the same thing, which has not always been the case between the two of them. You know, I think there's some chance that. There are places you can go where you can raise rates, not necessarily as much as the president said he planned to raise rates on the so-called wealthy. There are places where you can go. The New York Times floated a possibility where they said, you know, look, you could conceivably raise the tax rate on people who make more than $400,000 a year to, say, raise that up to 35%. And leave people who make less than that amount of money completely unaffected by any kind of marginal tax increase. And that might be able to figure out a clever way to raise taxes on the rich without raising marginal rates, which is where the Republicans are now drawing their line in the sand. We don't want to raise marginal rates, but they'll say, well, you know, maybe we can raise rates on capital gains. There are a lot of other possible ways to raise – that's a way of raising – raising taxes on the rich because the rich get most – a lot of their income out of capital gains. So there are a lot of different places to go here. There's also the possibility that we simply will go off the cliff
right.
on the question of tax increases, and all the Bush tax cuts will expire on January 1st. And then Democrats will simply vote immediately after January 1st, will come forward and say, hey, we're going to now reinstitute those Bush tax cuts on income under $250,000 a year. Republicans will vote for that because
right.
that's a tax cut. And they will have been allowed to then – the president will get to what he wants without Republicans ever having technically have to vote for a tax increase on marginal rates.
But if we get to that scenario, John, isn't that scary for the markets as we inch closer? Does that in the same way that the controversy over the debt ceiling, even though in the end it did not happen, just even the talk about it and the uncertainty around it led to huge swings, huge volatility in the market?
Well, you know, there are two pieces to the fiscal cliff, right? One piece is the end of the Bush tax cuts and what's going to happen to taxes. The other piece of the fiscal cliff is the sequester, which is the $1 trillion in spending cuts that automatically will kick in on January 1st if nothing's done before then. $500 billion in domestic discretionary spending, $500 billion in military spending. I think what the market has been concerned about is the notion that you would have both of those things take place at once and that the contractionary effect on the economy would be significant and lead to an immediate – like to plunge the country into recession. I think if – you know, if what most people now think in Washington that the sequester stuff is going to get kicked down the road, that there's a way you can extend that deadline into the early part of next year. And if you had what looked to the markets like an orderly process for dealing with the taxes, it's possible that you could talk the markets through to the point where it's unpredictability that messes up the markets, right? And so if there's a – if the market knows where things are going to end up through one process or another, whether it's a deal that comes before January 1st or what it is a predictable outcome shortly after January 1st, you might very well be able to escape all of the – at least the tax side, escape any market volatility. Again, if as long as they kind of get what the roadmap is, people in the markets that is, you might be able to not have that bad or deleterious effect on the stock market.
Amy Edding's in for Brian Lehrer, and I'm speaking with John Heilman of New York Magazine. Did the fiscal cliff come up at your Thanksgiving table? Did you talk politics at all? The phones are open for John Heilman, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Tell us what political questions came up in your Thanksgiving table conversation or what came up while you were waiting in line for those Black Friday early starter deals. Tell us if you managed to convince someone of your position or were swayed by somebody else's argument about what should happen with the fiscal cliff. 212-433-WNYC for your post-Thanksgiving pre-cliff political questions. John, Republicans seem to be honing in, as we heard Lindsey Graham talking about, on capping tax deductions as a way to raise revenue. Graham said it could raise up to $1 trillion. Put that in context for us. Can just capping tax deductions raise enough revenue?
There are a lot of independent analysts who think that you can get a lot of money out of dealing with deductions and closing loopholes in the code. And certainly, as a long-term vision of what tax reform would look like, almost everyone agrees that the notion of cleaning up the code and maintaining progressivity but bringing down rates, but getting rid of a lot of that stuff, and that some of that the loopholes and deductions are individual for rich people. Some of them are on the corporate side, but simplifying the code in some way is what I think both sides kind of agree is the right way to go. In the short term, though, a lot of independent analysts look at what you could the money you could get out of it, and still don't think that you're quite where you need to be and that there's going to have to be some increase in taxes on the rich. Now, again, like I said before, that could mean doing what Obama promised to do, which was basically to restore the Clinton-era tax rates for people for income over $250,000 a year. But, you know, he never talked about raising capital gains taxes. And you're starting to see in a more populist environment. And in the Republican Party, if you think 20 years ago, Republicans always argued against raising capital gains taxes and always argued for cutting capital gains rates. You now have a more populist Republican Party. And in a more populist Republican Party that's not actually at its grassroots necessarily any more favorably inclined towards fat cats than a lot of Democrats are, you're starting to hear more Republicans open to the idea conceivably of allowing those capital gains rates to rise. And you can get a lot of money out of that because there is a very rich pot of gold there to be tapped into.
Is this easier to do post-election than pre-election?
Oh, massively easier, because the one thing that's obviously true, and it was really interesting, again, talking to Cantor this morning, was the notion that, you know, Republicans they heard, you know, the Republican on a variety of fronts, whether it's on immigration or a million different areas of policy, but in fiscal policy too, Republicans heard the message of the elections, and the Republicans are in a posture now where they are rethinking a lot of things, and they are realizing that if they want to try to put themselves back in a better position than they have been as a national party, that they have to listen to voters who seem to be saying, "Please solve this problem," and that digging your heels in on purely ideological or quote principled grounds is not what people want. People do not want to see us go over this cliff, and people want to see more cooperation in Washington. Republicans seem at least a little bit seem to have heard that message and are starting to move a little bit in the right direction.
That clip we played of South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham, he ended it by saying he'll violate the Grover Norquist anti-tax pledge only if Democrats will do entitlement reform. Here's number two Senate Democrat Dick Durbin of Illinois, also on ABC yesterday morning, outlining his positions on the cliff, starting with high-end tax rates. And he's sounding a little friendly toward that possibility.
Let the rates go up to 39. Let us also take a look at the deductions. Let's make sure that revenue is an integral part of deficit reduction. And yes, from my side of the table, bring entitlement reform into the conversation. Social Security, set aside, doesn't add to the deficit. But when it comes to Medicare and Medicaid, protect the integrity of the program, but give it solvency for more and more years.
John Heilman, anything of note that you can parse out reading the tea leaves of what Senator Durbin is saying in that statement, where Democrats are headed in terms of entitlement reform?
Well, three things, I think. One is that Dick Durbin has been historically has been for a relatively liberal member of the Democratic caucus has been someone who's been willing to take on the notion of entitlement reform for quite a long time. He was one of the few Democrats who was in favor of Simpson-Bowles when it first came up. So this is where he's been for a while. That's the first thing. The second thing is the president, just as he would say that what he campaigned on in 2012 and what he has a mandate for, just as he would say raising taxes on wealthier Americans is one thing. A second thing he would say is he campaigned very explicitly on the notion of a balanced approach. And what a balanced approach meant in the Obama incarnation of it was we are going to raise taxes, but we're also going to do cuts on the spending side. His balance was $3 in spending cuts to $1 in revenue increases. That's been his position for a couple years. And to get the $3 in spending cuts, entitlements have been part of that. President Obama, back when he negotiated with John Boehner again over the grand bargain in the summer of 2011, put a lot of Medicare cuts on the table. So the president is in favor of doing some stuff on entitlements. And the third thing I'd say is that I do think that those two people, Dick Durbin, Barack Obama, are not far outside where the Democratic Party is now. There are people who are on the far left of the party who hate the idea of touching any entitlements. There's no question about that. But the Democratic caucus, I think, has internalized the notion that where the president and Dick Durbin are, whether they say it exactly that way or not, but that the notion that there's going to have to be some give on entitlement reform, that is baked into the cake for them. They'll argue about exactly how to do it. Should the money in Medicare come out of providers or should it come out of recipients? Should we raise the eligibility age or should we not? There's a lot of devils in those details. But the notion that we have got to do more to control the cost of Medicare and Medicaid in order to get over the long-term fiscal challenge
right.
The country faces is, I think most Democrats are on board with that.
But there it is, John, the devil's in the details. It's all very mushy. Durbin went on to say he would not accept raising the retirement age for Medicare eligibility. So what entitlement reform is on the table if Social Security isn't, and Medicare eligibility isn't.
Well, as I said, you know, with Medicare, there are a lot of Democrats who say that that you can get a lot of Medicare cost savings out of providers, so that the money should be taken out of the backs of insurance companies.
But at what point do they stop participating in Medicare at all then, and you drive them more and more, doctors not even accepting Medicare?
Those are very good questions. And look, you know, that question, the question of how do you what effect does the Affordable Care Act have on the secular growth of healthcare costs in general in the economy? It's an untested proposition right now. You know, there are a lot of people who have high hopes for what the president's healthcare reform will do in that regard as it gets implemented a couple years down the line and into the future. You know, we don't know the answers to those questions, and I don't in any way mean to sugarcoat this. There's going to be hard truths and hard pills to swallow for Democrats on some of these things. But I do think that, you know, there has been so much – Democrats are so hungry for Republican capitulation on the question of revenues that they are – as I say, they've been willing for a while now to unhappily swallow, as I said, some bitter pills on the notions of entitlements in order to get – to where everyone wants to go. There's a reason why, in fact, everyone kind of – the grand bargain is kind of in everyone's interest, not just in the short term but in the long term, because people on both the Democratic and Republican side of the aisle are sick of arguing about this, and there are so many other issues in terms of public policy that people would like to be discussing if we could get out from underneath the overhang of this long-term structural deficit that impedes – a lot of things, again, on both sides of the aisle, things that people would like to spend money on, things that people would like to make policy on, but they can't do it right now because they're handcuffed by the deficit and the long-term debt.
Amy Eddings speaking with John Heilman of New York Magazine about the fiscal cliff, taking your post-Thanksgiving pre-cliff calls. Jose from the Bronx, you're on WNYC. Good morning, Jose.
Good morning, Amy. Thanks for doing a good job. I just asked a question from your guest. What is the problem when we go over the physical cliff? There's nothing wrong with it. They're a global economy. I think they're making a big deal out of this. I would say to Democrats, just let it go over. What happened to Greece? Greece is still in the European community, and we keep talking about Greece is going to walk away. Greece cannot afford to walk away. They walk away, what are they going to do? So this physical cliff is a nonsense. I think it's a deadline to force the Congress to do something. And if they don't want to do anything, let it fall. Nothing is going to happen to the economy of the United States because we're a global economy. And that's my comment.
Jose, thank you. Thank you so much. Is he right? Is this more of a boogeyman, or are there real repercussions for not reaching some sort of deal by December 31st?
Well, one would, for most people in this country, the holding up the notion of what has happened to Greece. If you think about what Greek standards of living are now, if you think about what exactly Greek society and the Greek economy looks like now as being an acceptable outcome or anything like an acceptable outcome for America, most people would be like, I'm not sure I really want to go there. It's true they're still in the EU right now, but I don't think you really want to be living in Athens right now if you are someone happily living at anywhere near the median of the standard of living in America today. But it is true that the notion of the cliff is a little bit false in the sense that the policy changes that would kick in on January 1st, if there was no policy changes between now and then, the things that would happen on the tax side and in terms of spending, it would not all happen in one day.
Right.
It would phase in over some period of months.
Is that true for the cuts as well?
Well, the cuts would start, but again, the cuts would begin to kick in on January 1st, but you wouldn't feel the effect in the economy. It wouldn't be like literally the economy fell off a cliff within one 24-hour period. But it is the case that, as to your point, Amy, earlier, is that the notion that, again, for most private sector economic forecasters, if you take out – if nothing else changed and you raised taxes across the board on everybody in the country, and that was where things stood, and then you took out $1 trillion of spending on the government side, that the contractionary effects on the economy would be significant, not necessarily on January 2nd, but over the course of the first quarter of the year, the first half of the year. And for a very fragile economy, an economy that has been by no one's standard growing at the kind of pace in terms of GDP that we would like to see, that allows middle class wages to grow, et cetera, that is not a comfortable place to be. We are not at a place where we're growing like gangbusters and where you could absorb that kind of hit. The economy has been fragile for, you know,
for 4 years now.
Right.
And most people are risk averse, and I think rightly risk averse enough to think, you know, this is not something we really want to mess around with. We want to try to keep the economy on the gradual but fragile state of – we don't want to keep it fragile. We want to stay on some kind of gradual upward trajectory rather than messing around with what seems to be working a little bit right now.
And Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke warning last week that if we drive off the fiscal cliff, he feels it would put us back into recession.
Yes.
So.
And as you said before about the thing about the stock market, you know, I mean, you know, millions – you know, tens of millions of Americans with a lot of
– to all of our IRAs.
A lot of money wrapped up in the
accounts.
Stock market, right.
John, briefly, there's a growing sentiment among progressive Democrats. Yes, like Jose saying, let us go over the cliff because caving to cuts to the social safety net would not be worth trying to preserve middle class tax cuts. Do you see this argument gaining any support?
I don't particularly.
And is that in part because I think it was in your article, this remark that by one Democratic strategist that one thing that President Obama now has the freedom to do with his reelection is ignore the far left.
Yeah, I think that the president has people who have said that if Barack Obama got reelected, that he would govern way much further to the left than he governed in the first 4 years, I think have always been a little bit nuts because I don't think, A, he's governed from the far left to begin with. But he also, you know, he is needed to some extent to maintain a degree of progressive energy on the left in order to get reelected in 2012. He now no longer has to do that, and it frees him to go for what I think is his instinct, which is to try to put another big accomplishment on the mantelpiece for him. Healthcare reform will be the thing that his first term is remembered for. I think he thinks that the grand bargain – again, you can argue with him one way or the other, but he has wanted this grand bargain for a while. He wanted it back in the summer of 2011. He still wants it, and he still is basically approaching it the same way. I think that his attitude towards the left is, you know, you guys are going to have to come along with me now, not I'm going to have to kowtow. People get mad at that term, but I don't have to pay obeisance to you any longer to the extent that I ever did. This is now the time for me to try to get stuff done in the center because the truth is, as much as his election is a mandate for certain things and it was a convincing victory, we still have divided government in this country. And Barack Obama wants to get stuff done, and there's no real way to get stuff done with a divided government, at least for the next 2 years, with the House controlled by Republicans, without finding a deal in the middle as opposed to on the side, on the edge, on the left edge.
John Heilman is a political reporter for New York Magazine. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Amy.
The conversation continues online. Click on the Brian Lehrer Show page at WNYC.org. Up next, one day after Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi garnered praise for his role in negotiating a ceasefire in Gaza, he makes a power grab that throws the country into chaos. We'll ask what this means for diplomacy in the region and why the U.S. did not see this coming. Stay tuned.